Blog Talk Radio.
Lightning or some other interruption, because we are having a
same hour, and this turned out a very unfortunate occurrence for me, because living henceforth at inns, I was drained of my money very rapidly. I remember, folks, if you haven't heard last week, De Quincey was only about 17 years old at this point, and he ran away from school and went on his own, and with about 12 guineas, 12 pounds of money that he had, and he decided to seek an adventure here, but as you'll see, it turned out to be rather tough on him. And for a fortnight, I was reduced to a short allowance. That is, I could allow myself only one meal a day. From the keen appetite produced by constant exercise and mountain air acting on a youthful stomach, I soon began to suffer greatly on this slender regimen. For the single meal which I could venture to order was coffee or tea. Even this, however, was at length withdrawn, and afterwards, so long as I remained in Wales, I subsisted either on blackberries, hips, haws, and etc., or on the casual hospitalities which I now received in return for such little services as I had an opportunity of rendering. Sometimes I wrote letters of business for cottagers who happened to have relatives in Liverpool or in London. More often I wrote love letters to their sweethearts for young women who had lived as servants as Shrewsbury or other towns on the English border. On all such occasions, I gave great satisfaction to my humble friends and was generally treated with hospitality. And once in particular, in the village of Lan Ye Stone, in some such name, in a sequestered part of Merionethshire, I was entertained for upwards of 3 days by a family of young people with an affectionate and fraternal kindness that left an impression upon my heart not yet impaired. The family consisted at that time of 4 sisters and 3 brothers, all grown up, and all remarkable for elegance and delicacy of manner. So much beauty and so much native good breeding and refinement, I do not remember to have seen before or since in any cottage, except once or twice in Westmoreland and Devonshire. They spoke English, an accomplishment not often met with in so many members of one family, especially in villages remote from the high road. Here I wrote on my first introduction a letter about prize money for one of the brothers who had served on board an English man of war, and more privately, 2 love letters for 2 of the sisters. They were both interesting-looking girls, and one of uncommon loveliness. In the midst of their confusion and blushes, giving me general instructions, it did not require any great penetration to discover that what they wished was that their letters should be as kind as was consistent with properly maidenly pride. I contrived so to temper my expressions as to reconcile the gratification of those both feelings, and they were as much pleased with the way in which I had expressed their thoughts as in their simplicity. They were astonished at my having to readily discover them. The reception one meets with from the women of a family generally determines the tenor of one's whole entertainment. In this case, I had discharged my confidential duties as secretary, so much to their general satisfaction, perhaps also amusing them with my conversation, that I was pressed to stay with a cordiality which I had little inclination to resist. I slept with the brothers, and only unoccupied bed standing in the apartment of the young woman. But in all other points, they treated me with a respect not unusually paid to purses as light as mine, as if my scholarship were sufficient evidence that I was a gentle blood. Thus I lived with them for 3 days and great part of a fourth, and for the undiminished kindness which they continued to show me, I believe I might have stayed with them up to this time, if their power had corresponded with their wishes. On the last morning, however, I perceived upon their countenances, as they sat at breakfast, the expression of some unpleasant communication which was at hand. And soon after, one of the brothers explained to me that their parents had gone the day before my arrival to an annual meeting of Methodists held at Carnarvon, and were that day expected to return, and if they would not be so civil as they ought to be. He begged on the part of all the young people that I would not take it amiss. The parents returned with churlish faces, and in answer to all my addresses, I saw how matters stood, and so, taking an affectionate leave of my kind and interesting young host, I went my way, for though they spoke warmly to their parents on my behalf, and often excused the manner of the old people by saying it was only their way, yet I easily understood that my talent for writing love letters would do as little to recommend me with two grave sexagenarians, Welsh Methodists, as my Greek sapphics or alcaics. And what had been hospitality, when offered to me with the gracious courtesy of my young friends, would become charity when connected with the harsh demeanor of these old people. And certainly, Mr. Shelley is right in his notions about old age. Unless powerfully counteracted by all sorts of opposite agencies, it is a miserable corrupter and a blighter to the genial charities of the human heart. So much for old age. And soon after this, I contrived by means, which I must omit for want of room, to transfer myself to London. And now began the latter and fiercer stage of my long sufferings, without using the disproportionate expression of, I might say, of my agony, for I now suffered for upwards of 16 weeks the physical anguish of hunger in, at various degrees of intensity, but bitter perhaps as ever any human being can have suffered who has survived it would not needlessly harass my reader's feelings by a detail of all that I endured. For extremities such as these, under any circumstances of heaviest misconduct and guilt, cannot be contemplated, even in description, without a rueful pity that is painful to the natural goodness of the human heart. Let it suffice, at least, on this occasion, to say that a few fragments of bread from the breakfast table of one individual, who supposed me to be ill, but did not know of my being in utter want, and these at uncertain intervals constituted my whole support. During the former part of my sufferings, that is, generally in Wales and always for the first 2 months in London, I was houseless and very seldom slept under a roof. To this constant exposure to the open air, I ascribed it mainly that I did not sink under my torments. Latterly, however, when colder and more inclement weather came on, and when for the length of my sufferings I had begun to sink into a more languishing condition, it was no doubt fortunate for me that the same person for whose breakfast table I had access allowed me to sleep in a large unoccupied house at which he was tenant. Unoccupied, I called it, for there was no household or establishment in it, nor any furniture, indeed, except a table and a few chairs. But I found on taking possession of my new quarters that the house already contained one single inmate, a poor, friendless child, apparently 10 years old, but she seemed hunger-bitten, and suffering of that sort often makes children look older than they are. For this forlorn child, I learned that she had slept and lived there alone for some time before I came, and great joy the poor creature expressed when she found that I was in future to be her companion through the hours of darkness. And the house was large, and from the want of furniture, the noise of the rats made a prodigious echoing to the spacious staircase and halls, and amidst the real fleshy ills of cold and I fear hunger, the forsaken child had found leisure to suffer still more, it appeared, from the self-created one of ghosts. I promised her protection against all ghosts whatsoever, but alas, I could offer her no other assistance. We lay upon the floor with a bundle of cursed law papers for a pillow, but with no other covering than a sort of large horseman's cloak. Afterwards, however, we discovered in a garret and off an old sofa cover, a small piece of rug, and some fragments of other articles which added a little to our warmth. The poor child crept close to me for warmth and for security against her ghostly enemies. When I was not only that, but when I was not more than usually ill, I took her into my arms, so that in general she was tolerably warm and often slept when I could not. For during the last 2 months of my sufferings, I slept much in daytime, and was apt to fall into transient dozings at all hours. But my sleep distressed me more than my watching, for beside the tumultuousness of my dreams, which were only not so awful as those which I shall have to describe hereafter as produced by opium, my sleep was never more than what is called dog sleep, so that I could hear myself moaning, and was often, as it seemed to me, awakened suddenly by my own voice. And about this time, a hideous sensation began to haunt me as soon as I fell into a slumber, which was since returned upon me at different periods of my life, a sort of twitching, I know not where, but apparently about the region of the stomach, which compelled me violently to throw out my feet for the sake of relieving it. This sensation coming on as soon as I began to sleep, and the effort to relieve it constantly awakened me. At length, I slept only from exhaustion and from the increasing weakness. As I said before, I was constantly falling asleep and constantly waking. Meantime, the master of the house sometimes came in upon us suddenly and very early, sometimes not till 10 o'clock, sometimes not at all. He was in constant fear of bailiffs. Improving on the plan of Cromwell, every night he slept in a different quarter of London, and I observed that he never failed to examine through a private window the appearance of those who knocked at the door before he would allow it to be opened. And he breakfasted alone. Indeed, his tea equipage would hardly have admitted of his hazarding an invitation to a second person. Anyone with this quantity of esculent material, which for the most part was little more than a roll or a few biscuits which he had bought on his road from the place where he had slept, or if he had asked a party, as I once learnedly and fastidiously observed to him, several members of it must have stood in relation to each other. As the metaphysicians have it, and not of a coexistence in the relationship of the parts of time and not of the parts of space. During his breakfast, I generally contrived a reason for lounging in, and with an air of as much indifference as I could assume, took up such fragments as he had left. Sometimes, indeed, there were none at all. In doing this, I committed no robbery except upon the man himself, to which thus obliged, I believe, now and then to send out at noon for an extra biscuit, whereas to the poor child, she was never admitted into his study. If I may give that name to his chief depository of parchments, log writings, etc., that room was to her the Bluebeard room of the house, being regularly locked in his departure to dinner. About 6 o'clock, which usually was his final departure for the night, Whether this child were an illegitimate daughter of Mr. X or only a servant, I could not ascertain. She did not herself know, but certainly she was treated altogether as a menial servant. No sooner did Mr. X make his appearance than she went below stairs, brushed his shoes, coat, and etc., and except when she was summoned to run an errand, she never emerged from the dismal Tartarus of the kitchen to the upper air until my welcome knock at night called up her little trembling footsteps to the front door. Of her life during the daytime, however, I knew little, but what I gathered from her own account at night, for as soon as the hours of business commenced, I saw that my absence would be acceptable, and in general, therefore, I went off and sat in the parks or elsewhere until nightfall. But who and what, meantime, was the master of the house himself? Reader, he was one of those anonymous practitioners in lower departments of the law. Who, on prudential reasons, or from necessity, deny themselves all indulgence in the luxuries of too delicate or a conscience. In many walks of life, a conscience is more expensive encumbrance than a wife or a carriage, and just as people talk of laying down their carriages, so I suppose my friend Mr. X had laid down his conscience for a time, meaning doubtless to resume it as soon as he could afford it. Interesting. The inner economy of such a man's daily life would present a most strange picture. If I could allow myself to amuse the reader at his expense, even with my limited opportunities for observing what went on, I saw many scenes of London intrigues and complex chicanery, cycles and epicycles, orb and orb, at which I sometimes smile to this day, and at which I smile then in spite of my misery. My situation, however, at that time gave me little experience in my own person of any qualities of Mr. X's character, but such as did him honor. And of his whole strange composition, I must forget everything but that towards me he was obliging, and to the extent of his power, generous. That power was not indeed very extensive. However, in common with the rats, I sat rent-free. And as Dr. Johnson has recorded that he never but once in his life had as much wall fruit as he could eat. So let me be grateful that on that single occasion I had a large choice of apartments in a London mansion as I could possibly desire, except the Bluebeard room, which the poor child believed to be haunted. All others, from the attics to the cellars, were at our service. The world was all before us, and we pitched our tent on the night in any spot we chose. And this house I have already described as a large one. It stands in a conspicuous situation and in a well-known part of London, and many of my readers will have passed it. I doubt not within a few hours of this reading, for myself I never fail to visit it when business draws me to London. About 10 o'clock this very night, August 15th, 1821, being my birthday, I turned aside from my evening walk down Oxford Street, purposely, to take a glance at it. It is now occupied by a respectable family, and by the light in the front drawing room, I observe a domestic party assembled, perhaps at tea, and apparently cheerful and gay. And a marvelous contrast in my eyes to the darkness, cold silence, and desolation of what same house 18 years ago, when its nightly occupants were one famishing scholar and a neglected child. Her, by the by, in after years, I vainly endeavored to trace. Apart from her situation, she was not what would be called an interesting child. She was neither pretty nor quick in understanding, nor remarkably pleasing in manners. But thank God, even in those years, I needed not the embellishments of novels, accessories to consolate my affections. Plain a human nature, in its humblest and most homely apparel, was enough for me, and I loved the child because she was my partner in wretchedness. If she is now living, she is probably a mother, with children of her own. But as I have said, I could never trace her. I'm going to stop for 1 second and just comment on that, because there was a time when I was about that age when I was traveling, hitchhiking, and I was basically homeless. I didn't really have a place. I was 18, and I had gone on a slight journey, I guess, if you will. And I left school, and that's why this story always captured my imagination, because I was going through this kind of thing myself. And you find, as you go through this phase of traveling, hitchhiking, and you're kind of at the mercy of your destiny, you suffer hunger, you suffer. I remember I was on the road for a couple of days, and I was, on a highway, and didn't have too much money, and a guy picked me up, and he just bought a foot long, sub sandwich, grinder they call them, and he had a gallon of wine, and we were driving along. He was a student at BU, I guess, something, and he was going down. And he shared the sandwich with me, and got kind of drunk, and I happened to have a special cigarette there for, that I shared with him, and he stopped, and we got kind of down to I remember Hartford, Connecticut, and he had taken me some, maybe 100 miles or so where I was, and I was on the middle of the highway where a truck had stopped, and changed, and I was headed toward another direction. And I remember the hospitality of the many times I was on the road, and the people that picked me up, and the kind people, gentle people, good people, people of modest means. But back in those days, hitchhiking was a way of getting around. I didn't have any money, and I didn't have a car. And I was 18 years old, and just moving along. So the kindness of people caught me in this story, and the hunger, desperation, sometimes worry, but it was more the journey. What's going to come next? Who's next? What's next? And that's what kept you going. And I'm sorry I got off on the wrong track, but this story brought back some great memories of my own journeys back in the past, this early 70s. And I just wanted to mention it. He says of this young girl that he could never trace her. With this I regret, but another person there was at that time whom I had since sought to trace with deeper, far deeper earnest, and with far deeper sorrow at my failure. This person was a young woman, and one of that unhappy class who subsists on the wages of prostitution. I feel no shame, nor have any reason to feel it, avowing that I was then on familiar and friendly terms with many women in that unfortunate condition. The reader needs neither smile at this avowal nor frown, for not to remind my classical readers of the old Italian, the old Latin proverb, sene sinceri, it may well be supposed that in the existing state of my purse, my connection with such women could not have been an impure one. But the truth is that at no time of my life have I been a person to hold myself polluted by the touch or approach of any creature that wore a human shape. On the contrary, from my very earliest youth, it was been my pride to converse familiarly, more Socratio, with all human beings, man, woman, and child, that chance might fling in my way, a practice which is friendly to the knowledge of human nature, to good feelings, and to that frankness of address which becomes a man who would be thought a philosopher. For a philosopher should not see his eyes of these poor, limitary creatures, calling himself a man of the world, and filled with narrow and self-regard prejudices of birth and education, but should look upon himself as a Catholic creature, and as standing in an equal relation to the high and low, to educated and uneducated, to the guilty and to the innocent. Being myself at that time of necessity a peripatetic or a walker of the streets, I naturally fell in more frequently with those female peripatetics who are technically called streetwalkers. Many of these women had occasionally taken my part against watchmen who wished to drive me off the steps of houses where I was sitting. But one amongst them, the one whose account I have at all introduced the subject, yet no, let me not class the O, noble-minded Anne, and the order of women. Let me find, if it be possible, some gentler name to designate the condition of her through whose bounty and compassion ministering to my necessities when all the world had forsaken me. I owe it that I am at this time alive. For many weeks I had walked all nights with this poor friendless girl up and down Oxford Street, or had rested with her on steps and under the shelter of porticos. She could not be so old as myself. She told me, indeed, that she had not completed her 16th year. By such questions as my interests about her prompted, I had gradually drawn forth her simple history. Hers was a case of ordinary occurrence, as I had since had reason to think, and once in which, if London beneficence had better adapted its arrangements to meet it, the power of the law might oftener be interposed to protect and to avenge. But the stream of London charity flows in a channel which, though deep and mighty, is yet noiseless and underground, not obvious or readily accessible to poor houseless wanderers, and it cannot be denied that the outside air and framework of London society is harsh, cruel, and repulsive. In any case, however, I saw that part of her injuries might easily have been redressed, and I urged her often and earnestly to lay her complaint before a magistrate. Friendless as she was, I assured her that she would meet with immediate attention, and that English justice, which was no respecter of persons, would speedily and amply avenge her on the brutal ruffian who had plundered her little property. She promised me often that she would, but she delayed taking the steps, and I pointed out from time to time, for she was timid and dejected to a degree which showed how deeply sorrow had taken hold of her young heart, and perhaps she thought justly that the most upright judge and the most righteous tribunals could do nothing to repair her heaviest wrongs. And something, however, would perhaps have been done, for it had been settled between us at length but unhappily on the very last time, but one that I was ever to see her, that in a day or two we should go together before a magistrate, and that I should speak on her behalf. This little service it was destined, however, that I should never realize. Meantime, that which she rendered to me, and which was greater than I could ever have repaid her, was this. One night when she was pacing slowly along Oxford Street, and after a day when I had never passed, and after a day when I had felt more than usual ill and faint, I requested her to turn off with me into Soho Square. Hither she went, and we sat down on the steps of a house. This to this hour I never pass without a pang of grief and an inner act of homage to the spirit of that unhappy girl, in memory of the noble action which she had there performed. Suddenly, as we sat, I grew much worse. I had been leaning my head against her bosom, and all at once I sank from my arms and fell backwards on the steps from the sensation I had then had. I felt an inner conviction of the liveliest kind that without some powerful and reviving stimulus I would either have died on the spot or should at least have sunk to a point of exhaustion from which all reason, under my friendliness, friendliest circumstances would soon have been hopeless. Then it was at this crisis of my fate that my poor orphan companion, who had herself met with little but injuries in this world, stretched out a saving hand to me, utterly a cry of terror, but without a moment's delay, she ran off into Oxford Street, and in less time than could be imagined, returned to me with a glass of port wine and spices that acted upon my empty stomach, which at the time would have rejected all solid food with the instantaneous power of restoration. And for this glass, the generous girl, without a murmur, paid out of her humble purse at a time, be it remembered, when she had scarcely wherewithal to purchase the bare necessities of life, and when she could have no reason to expect that I would ever be able to reimburse her. O youthful benefactress, how often in succeeding years, standing in solitary places and thinking of thee with grief of heart and perfect love, how often have I wished that, as of ancient times, the curse of a father was believed to have a supernatural power and to pursue its object with a fatal necessity of self-fulfillment. Even so, the benediction of a heart oppressed with gratitude might have a like prerogative, might have power given to it from above to chase, to haunt, to waylay, to overtake, to pursue thee into central darkness of a London brothel, or if it were possible, into the darkness of the grave, there to awaken thee with an authentic message of peace and forgiveness and a final reconciliation. I do not often weep, for not only do my thoughts on subjects connected with the chief interests of man daily, may hourly descend 1,000 fathoms, too deep for tears. Not only does the sternness of my habits of thought present an antagonism to the feeling which prompts tears, wanting of necessity to those who, being protected usually by their levity from any tendency to meditative sorrow, would by that time same levity be made incapable of resisting it on any casual access of such feelings. But also I believe that all minds which have contemplated such objects as deeply as I have done must, for their own protection from utter despondency, have early encouraged and cherished some tranquilizing belief as to the future balances and hieroglyphic meaning of human sufferings. On these accounts, I am cheerful to this hour, and as I have said, I do not often weep. Yet some feelings, though not deeper or more passionate, are more tender than others, and often, when I walk at this time in Oxford Street by dreamy lamplight, and hear those airs played on a barrel organ, which years ago solaced me with my dear companion, and I must always call her, I shed tears and amused with myself at the mysterious dispensation which so suddenly and so critically separated us forever. How it happened, the reader will understand from the remains of this introductory narration. Soon after the period of the last incident I had recorded, I met in Albemarle Street a gentleman of His Late Majesty's household. The gentleman had received hospitalities on different occasions from my family, and he challenged me upon the strength of my family likeness. I did not attempt any disguise. I answered his questions ingenuously, and on his pledging his word of honor that he would not betray me to my guardians, I gave him an address to my friend and the attorney. The next day, I received from him a 10-pound banknote. The letter enclosing it was delivered with other letters of business to the attorney, but though his look and manner informed me that he suspected its contents, he gave it up to me honorably and without demur. This present, from the particular service to which it was applied, leads me naturally to speak of the purpose which had allured me up to London, which I had been, to use a forensic word, soliciting from the first day of my arrival in London to that of my final departure. In so mighty a world as London, it will surprise my readers that I should not have found some means of starving off the last extremities of penury, and it will strike them that two resources, at least mine, must have been open to me: either to seek assistance from the friends of my family, or to turn my youthful talents and attainments into some channel of pecuniary emolument. As to the first course, I may observe generally that what I dreaded beyond all other evils was the chance of my being reclaimed by my guardians, not doubting that whatever power the law gave them would have been enforced against me to the utmost, that is, to the extremity of forcibly restoring me to the school which I had quitted, a restoration which, as I would in my eyes have been a dishonor, even if submitted to voluntarily, could not fail when extorted from me in contempt, in defiance of my own wishes and efforts, to have been a humiliation worse to me than death, and which would indeed have terminated in death. I was therefore shy enough of applying for assistance even in those quarters where I was sure of receiving it, as the risk of furnishing my guardians with any clue of recovering me. But as to London in particular, though doubtless my father had in his lifetime had many friends there, yet as 10 years had passed since his death, I remembered few of them even by name, and never having seen London before except once for a few hours, I knew not the address of even those few. To this mode of gaining help, therefore, in part the difficulty, but much more the paramount fear, which I have mentioned, habitually indisposed me. In regard to the other mode, I now feel half inclined to join my readers in wondering what I should have overlooked. As a corrector of Greek proofs, if in no other way, I might doubtless have gained enough for my slender wants. Such an office as this I could have discharged with an exemplary and punctual accuracy that would soon have gained me the confidence of my employers. But it must not be forgotten that even for such an office as this, it was necessary that I should first of all have an introduction to some respectable publisher, and this I had no means of obtaining. To say the truth, however, it had never once occurred to me to think of literary labors as a source of profit. No mode sufficiently speedy of obtaining money had ever occurred to me but that of borrowing it on the strength of my future claims and expectations. This mode I sought by every avenue to compass, and amongst other persons I applied to a Jew named D. stigmatizing moneylenders, some of whom were, I believe, also Jews, I had introduced myself with an account of my expectations, which account on examining my father's will, doctor's commons, they had ascertained to be correct. The person there, mentioned as the son of, a second son of, was found to have all the claims, or more than all, that I had stated. But one question still remained, and which the faces of the Jews pretty significantly suggested, was I that person? The doubt had never occurred to me as a possible one. I had rather feared, whenever my Jewish friends scrutinized me keenly, that I might be too well known to be that person, and that some scheme might be passing in their minds for entrapping me and selling me to my guardians. It was strange to me to find my own self material letter considered. So I expressed it, for I doted on logical accuracy of distinctions, accused or at least suspected of counterfeiting my own self formal letter considered. However, to satisfy the scruples, I took the only course in my power. Whilst I was in Wales, I had received various letters from young friends. These I produced, for I carried them constantly in my pocket, being indeed, by the time, almost the only relic of my personal encumbrances, excepting the clothes I wore, which I had not, in one way or another, disposed of. Most of these letters were from the Earl of Blank, who was at that time my chief, or rather only confidential friend. These letters were dated from Eton. I had also some from the Marquis of Blank, his father, who, though absorbed in agricultural pursuits, yet having been an Estonian himself, and as good a scholar as a nobleman needs to be, still retained an affection for classical studies and for youthful scholars. And he had accordingly, from the time I was 15, corresponded with me, sometimes upon the great improvements which he had made for or was meditating in the countries of in the state M and Psi, since I had been there, sometimes upon the merits of a Latin poet, and at other times suggesting subjects to me on which he wished me to write verses. There's quite a bit more to the story, and I'm sorry I started late today, but I'm going to try to complete this. I'll have to do it, I believe, in next session next week. But I wanted to get into the pains of opium. Introduction to the pains of opium and to his addictions, and I really, as well as the pleasures of opium, which would be part two. Unfortunately, I'm not going to have time to do that tonight. I regret that I started late tonight, but unfortunately, because of the storm, I was delayed starting. But next week, please join me next week when I will continue this, and I'd like to get into the part two of the story, where he talks about the pleasures of opium, his involvement, and the pains of opium and his addiction. And his nightmares and some of the things that eventually happened to him. So with that, I will leave you. And I want to thank everybody for listening to me tonight. I hope you will join me again tomorrow. Not tomorrow, join me again next week when I do part three of